7.9 Pirate Cat Radio. That is our new periodic apocalypse theme, and I'm sitting here in the studio with Daniel Coffeen, PhD, who is now live on the mic. Speak up.
That's good to know. Hello, hello, hello. I'm here.
It's time to get started. We have some duties to perform here at Pirate Cat. We got to get through a couple of news headlines, and I'm DJ Prefect. Urging you to don't panic, and especially when I'm with Dan and Dave, and who usually chimes in saying keep it organic. But I'm going to drop all science news because I feel like it. So, science news number one, want responsible robotics? Start with responsible humans in Science Daily. In the current issue of journal IEEE Intelligent Systems, two engineers propose alternative laws to rewrite our future with robots. This is much like the Isaac Asimov rules for compatible robotics with humanity. Go back to the original context of the stories, Woods says. Woods being this guy from university. I haven't actually read this news. I'm just like doing this obligation thingy. He's using three laws as a literary device. The plot is driven by the gaps in these laws, the situations in which the laws break down. In other words, he's using a literary analysis to prescribe a mode of action for scientists to take when they design robots. He's saying that the books are all about where these things break down. So don't design robots with these laws in mind. Design robots with the fact that these laws break down in mind. Otherwise, you get world robot domination. So, okay. Next, in Science Daily, we have more weight equals longer hospital stays. Sociologists weigh in on obesity increasing the length of hospital stays. So they found a direct relationship between obesity and duration and the frequency of hospital stays. So basically,
shocking headline.
The fatter they are, the fatter they fall, basically. Obesity is also linked to an increased risk of heart disease, diabetes, stroke, and other illnesses. The numbers on our nation's scales are still going up, have been going up since the 80s and the 90s. It's kind of this long-running experiment with a low-carb or a high-carb, low-fat diet, which is completely completely misguided, apparently. We just sit.
I'm telling you, it's because if you make people bigger, you can actually accelerate productivity. I'm telling you, in an information economy, it's about acceleration. It's no longer an industrial economy. We don't need bodies anymore. It's about speeding people up because they only want them to fill in the little gaps of the computational.
I told you I'd bring in some articles that are topical here.
I like it.
They're all right.
Perfect.
But I still think of them as just an obligation. So next in Science Daily, we have just expecting a tasty food actually activates the brain reward system. The mere expectation that you're about to receive a tasty treat activates dopamine receptors.
Yeah, that's good. That's like every storefront in the world now, right?
Exactly. And if you read the end of Overeating, which is that book that I keep touting, the author goes into detail about the ways in which advertising basically uses these jacking up of emotions to make you desire the food more and to increase your dopamine receptivity.
Right. Well, at some point it becomes, that is the consumption.
You
don't actually need to consume anything anymore.
Exactly. Well, this is exactly what this research shows.
The desire to consume, that is the end result.
Right.
Right.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. You don't even need to have the food to have the to have this activation in the brain,
right.
This pleasure sensation in the brain. You just need to
desire it enough. It's like the ultimate productivity. You don't actually have to make the product. I got to talk about the product. It's brilliant.
Moving right along, scientists create an energy-burning brown fat in mice. So this is along the lines of, hey, we're so fat and we can't control ourselves. Let's, context. Brown fat actually increases your metabolic rate of calorie expenditure. So they've found that by tweaking the genetic code, they can create mice that have more brown fat than regular fat, and that increases their metabolic rate, and they don't end up obese. So, again, this falls under the realm of let's genetically modify people because they can't stop eating so much, can't stop consuming.
Can I confess something that when I was just home recently, my mother told me I'm a skinny boy, and my mother told me that I have a lot of brown fat.
Really?
She just told me this, yes.
That's
our
quite
family
advanced.
Is rich in brown fat.
I
didn't know how to
say?
Take it, but who knew, Naomi, that
See?
You would tie it all in.
Hey, there you go. So that's it. That's the science news. Those are the required four headlines. So that means that we are free to do whatever we want until we have to do a PSA. So I'm going to get a PSA out of the way right now. Would you like to do one? There's one on smothering.
Yeah, here. I'll read something. I just read this verbatim.
Yeah, and don't forget the bottom line as well.
Okay, smothering. You had a tough day at the office. So you come home, make yourself some dinner, smother your kids. Jesus, pop in a movie, maybe have a drink. It's fun, right? Wrong. Don't smother your kids. The more you know.
This PSA?
This PSA is brought to you by your friends at Pirate Cat Radio, 87.9 FM.
Damn right. Okay. We're going to cut to a quick break and then we'll set ourselves up out there in sort of a lecture-y capacity and be with you in a moment. Pirate Cat Radio, 87.9 FM.
Walk marathons and take on whatever together.
There's nothing I forgot. I left that paper heart where it belonged, who it belonged to. I never knew. I never, never knew.
87.9 FM Pirate Cat Radio. Tonight we have the Periodic Apocalypse presents The Extermination of the Human Host, and I have our guests here. Would you like to introduce yourselves?
Meg, thank you. Hey, my name's Naomi Most, aka DJ Prefect, which is what you will know me by for the rest of the evening. And our honored guest here is Professor Daniel Coffeen, or how would you like to be known, Daniel Coffeen? Daniel. Is he on?
I'm not on.
No, there you go. I am allowed at large. I'm a sophist at large. I'm a
sophist
pervert
at large.
Yeah, I'm certainly not a professor.
So I encountered Coffeen on podcasts, actually. iTunes, found his rhetoric lectures, thought they were awesome. The end.
Thank you, Naomi. Those are good lectures. Listen to those.
And I decided that that we need to put together a conversation on the air on Pirate Cat Radio. And I asked him, what do you want to talk about? What's new and exciting? What's amazing? And he came back and told me what wasn't amazing and why he thought so. And we ended up with this Extermination of the Human Host Pirate Cat Radio special here, which is highly inflammatory title, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. It all seems so self-evident to me that I'm always surprised that it's inflammatory. It speaks for itself. The symptoms are so explicit. It's not subtle, that of which I speak.
Well, what exactly is exterminating the human host?
You know, it's funny. I came to this realization through experience, right? Not through books. And then I turned to books for answers, but I already had the answers. And what's exterminating the human host are the fundamental conditions of this life, right? The economy of capital and desire, right? And the way that private affective pleasure is being systematically eradicated. That every time I turn to try to eke some pleasure from this life, it is quashed, it is exterminated, I keep being surprised that I can't eke out a life of that feels human to me. And then I began to realize that there's an acceleration of a condition of life, of a certain drive to a certain existence, driven by an understanding of capital that will not let me be.
Won't let you be. But aren't we surrounded by sort of like this paradise of things that are entirely very pleasurable, designed to be pleasurable, in fact?
I think my premise begins with the fact that the human body is a desiring machine. It wants, it relishes this world. It delects, it delectates, it consumes, but in its consumption, it is capable of supreme enjoyment. Right? And I think it's my premise that humanity, or one characteristic of the human species, is this will to desire. What's happened is capitalism, and I'll use this word, and we'll qualify this word over time, because I do not mean an economic system per se, as if you choose an economic system. We can talk about the loaded word of capitalism.
There's a lot of loaded words on our poster.
Yeah, capitalism seems, no, but capitalism has triggered more than anything. And it's, you know, because what I'm not talking about the juxtaposition of capitalism versus communism, right? They might very well be the same thing. That is not the juxtaposition. The juxtaposition I offer is between the body of pleasure and the body of labor, which is a distinction that I steal, if you care, from Herbert Marcuse's book on Freud, Eros and Civilization, right? Can you structure an economy around a body of pleasure? Around a body that can enjoy itself and enjoy its experience in this world versus a body that is a means to another ends, right? To a collective ends or a corporate ends. Corporate being not just business, but any collective ends. So maybe communism would be the same thing. That's not my juxtaposition. My juxtaposition is between Michel Houellebecq, who speaks about adolescence as the apogee of existence because it is the time when the desiring body is at its peak, versus Newt Gingrich, who argues that adolescence is a failed experiment and should be eliminated. Right? It is about pleasure versus labor. And so when Naomi talks about all the things that are sort of around us, what capitalism has gotten so good at, and again, I'll qualify this word capitalism in a moment, is usurping the pleasure principle, usurping the human will to desire, and substituting enjoyment of life with consumption of life. So rather than actually enjoying things, and what I mean by enjoying is a kind of a lingering over, a kind of sumptuous delectation, a taking in and a wallowing in one's affective complexity, one's, you know, letting that raw fuckanoony, man, fall across your tongue and tickle your palate and taking a sip of that tequila and enjoying that thing.
I knew it would come around to the tequila at some point.
It always comes back to tequila. Versus, you know, getting that iPhone, getting those, you know, going to that hip new place, having that new wine, getting that weird food, constantly that endless drive that will never be sated versus enjoyment, which can in fact be sated.
It seems really funny to me about the idea that we can consume new places, we can consume new things, we can go to that hip new place and so on and so forth, is that quite often what you hear when people come back from that hip new place or that remote tropical destination is, wow, those people are able to languidly eat a meal all evening. How can this be? How can this happen? And it's interesting to me that people don't think that it's possible, or that it's an amazing feat of humanity to be able to sit and actually enjoy the things that you've got in front of you.
Yeah, I mean, to me, pleasure is slow, right? I mean, to me, one of the great conspiracies, and this is going to sound really crass, but it's something I've come to realize, is we talk about ass pleasure, right? Especially in men. Right, the ass is a site of great pleasure in men, right? But we're told it's not, and it's cloaked in a lot of homophobia and things like that. But the fact of the matter is, butt love, male or female, is slow. It's slow, right? It really takes time. It's a very delicate thing, but at some point. Capitalism and this thing I'm calling the capitalist virus, this will to replication, is accelerating at an alarmingly fast pace. It has a will to speed that, and in order to accomplish this state of acceleration, it has to eliminate pleasure, because pleasure is slow.
Well, what do we have right now? I mean, don't we have something great here involving some great progress, some great technology, great science, skyscrapers and airplanes and that sort of thing? Isn't that awesome? I mean,
well, yeah, well,
so there's a sense in which Americans basically led the drive to accomplish all of these things, and so
we're ground zero for this viral mutation, and so yeah, I mean progress. There's a lot of guises that this virus that I'm talking about, and again, I'll talk about why it's a virus, right? There's a lot of guises it uses to mask itself. One is progress. One is that it's a system that you choose. Right, the idea of choice, the whole framing of the debate around capitalism is that it's capitalism or communism. And this just makes the most sense, so let's choose it. But when I say capitalism, I'm by no means referring to an economic system. The idea that an exchange of finance could somehow be separated from human desire and human bodies is itself the insanity, is itself part of the lie. Right? Anybody, even in business, every businessman knows. I mean, this is the fucking world I work in, right? It's called branding, right? Forget that it's the most humiliating thing on the planet, but it is about infecting or infusing the financial economy with affective experience. That's the job. The businessman come up with a business plan, and they come to the creative wonks in San Francisco, so-called creative wonks in San Francisco, and say, ran this for me. And we give them a mood because, of course, any economy is both financial, it's affective, it's bodily. When I'm talking about capitalism, then, I'm talking about fundamental behaviors. It's not something exterior to us. It is us. They're not the capitalists and then us. There's not the CEOs or the Wall Street guys that are capitalists. And when you're in branding or you're working at the cafe, you're not a capitalist. Capitalism is us. The virus has subsumed us. We are this thing, right? The person, the greatest crime to me is the person who goes to work.
When I was doing some reading in preparation for this, I was doing trying to get a little historical context and try to figure out how we got into this situation where, real wages actually haven't changed since about the 1970s. And people actually work and produce about 20% more. So real wages haven't changed, but we're producing more. People are being, slated to work longer hours, or they've got to work two jobs and no one's being paid anymore. Meanwhile, we have outrageous corporate bonuses such as have never been seen in the history of anything in the 80s and 90s. And this is interesting. So I wanted to go back a little bit earlier and say, how did we get into that situation? And I was looking at the war. I was looking at the couple of wars that we fought where we're quashing all the evil communist and evil dictatorship stuff that was going on in Europe. And we came out victorious. We came out economically victorious. And we were putting people in factories. We were doing a war machine, that sort of thing. And we ramped up production. We ramped up an economy, and we also caused people to slot themselves into an economy where we were ramped up. People came back from that, and because we had already set up this structure in which everyone had to work a certain degree, and even women had to start working out of the home as well, more people had to work a little bit longer. At the same time, Europe was destroyed. Europe was like rubble, and America was doing doing pretty well, being very productive. Europe knew that if they were going to compete on a global platform, that they were going to have to produce as much and be as technologically advanced and catch up and be awesome at everything. This in the same way that we were, and Asia as well, and Japan. And they got to that. They got to that in about the 1970s or so. I'm like, that's interesting. In 1970s, about the same time when wages stopped increasing. Like, we had an increasing wage situation. We had an increasing consumption situation. Until the 1970s. And what happened is that they caught up and they started producing just as much as the Americans had. And so America, with its love of consumption, we've kind of sort of got people addicted to consumption. We invented fast food in that time. We needed to be more productive. And yet we didn't actually have the export capability. We didn't actually have the incoming revenue to do it. So what's the solution to that? Well, we somehow get people to work more without paying them anymore. And I'm not actually going to speak to any more of this because I'm not a history expert. I'm not an economics expert, but I do see this trend where we sort of got ourselves on a trajectory where we're paying people about the same and getting them to work more and creating and being very, very productive. I mean, we did end up exceeding the rest of the world economies, even though we no longer make cars and electronics and that sort of thing. And that was the whole economic race that happened. But now we need to consume these things. So anyway, real wages never went up. So how do you get people to consume more when they don't actually have any more money, and there's actually no physical hours and no more physical hours that you can have them work? Well, you have to give them debt. You know, you have to get them into debt in some way. And the 80s are sort of the invention of the credit card. And somewhere around the 80s or the 90s, you have car companies realizing that it was actually more profitable to sell people some debt to get the car. And to be banks, essentially, like GM Motors, I can't remember what their bank was called. Right, they don't make money selling cars or making cars. That's why GM's never made a good car. You know, in the past 30 years, they set themselves up as a bank. And they found that instead of raising wages to get people to consume, what they do is sell debt. So we have, so consumers have the most debt of any time in history. And still they're on this consumption platform because things kind of obsolete themselves within a couple years. So you have to, you know, there's no real ownership, right? There's nothing to own. You have to keep buying stuff. And we've made it that way because we don't manufacture anything that lasts anymore because apparently that's too expensive.
you had a really, really nice, it's really nice historical argument. True or not, fuck if I know. But beautiful, right? Because you get the wedding of the military, right? Which is the colonial thread to ramping up speed and the will to more, right? The reason I call capitalism a virus is that it seeks to replicate itself, right? And it is based on a principle of more. More is all our assessors of success turn on the notion of more, right? Just think about Wall Street, right? It's such a simple, it's so fucking obvious, right? In order for a public company to be considered successful, it has to grow. More is good, right? That is the definition of a virus.
Right.
That is the definition of it seeks simply to replicate itself. More is a quantitative will. It is a will to quantity, right? It's not, I want, someone who really digs uni doesn't want more uni, wants good uni. It gets qualified with a qualifier, not a quantity.
I can attest to that, yeah.
Right? Somebody who likes tequila, not a drunk, right? To compare the person who likes tequila to the alcoholic is to introduce what Burroughs calls the junk equation. And capitalism is the junk equation. It is an equation of need that is fundamentally parasitic, that will never satisfy itself, will endlessly devalue itself. The more junk you take, the more junk you need. You take more and more, you get less and less satisfied until the reserve, until it becomes literally valueless. Any quantitative system will exhaust itself, Burroughs says, and I, you know, agree, because it will simply, value becomes meaningless, right? It will always exhaust its own generation of value, right? And so you get this endless will to more.
Here's a perspective from a book that I heartily recommend called The End of Overeating, which explores the tendency for humans to enlarge, especially in the past 20 to 30 years. Basically, in surrounded by plenty, you decide, you ramp up your notions of how much is enough. And surrounded by plenty, you are constantly exceeding your notions of what's a reward. So, whereas there's some great quotes from the founder of Cinnabon, actually. And, they designed a bun. You know, they designed it around the attractiveness of the fat and the salt. They specifically tweaked every little bit of it.
And that smell.
Yeah. That smell, exactly. I don't know why this sticks out so for me so much, but I was in the mall when I was like 8 years old and I was walking through the mall with my mom and I smelled the smell, right? My mom runs into an old friend of hers who had just opened a Cinnabon around the corner and she's asking him like, what do you do for advertising? This is a brand new chain. This is like the mid 80s. Brand new chain. He's like, we don't advertise. Actually, it's against public our corporate policy to advertise. All we do is make sure that the smell reaches throughout the mall. That's their advertising platform. That's what they knew would draw people in. It's like, fine. That's all well and good. What's really interesting about this book is that, there's quotes from the founder of the company, this woman who started out, you know, the American dream. She starts out in a barn and all that. And she said, gosh, I never intended people to eat this more than once a week. This is, or, you know, at most, like, this is a special treat. And yet I see people coming in every single day because this is their, you know, after they have a meatball sub, this is their dessert. Like every single day. And the stories that she hears from people are things like, yeah, I just wanted to reward myself for like getting out of bed, you know? It's just bizarre. I mean, we've lost all sense of perspective. We've lost that zero point, which is what I think meditation is so good for.
Absolutely.
And there's a reason they tell you always to totally zero out your battery, like when you're recalibrating the battery in your laptop, your electronics, and that sort of thing, which is that the laptop's electronics lose the sense of zero after a while, and then it thinks that it's run out of energy before it's gotten to that zero point, and then it looks like you have less energy, right? That's what I feel like is the point of meditation, is to get you back to that zero point so that you know, like, that you know the difference between a treat and Cinnabon every single day.
I'm just thinking about Cinnabon. It is a delirium. But what I do want to move into a little bit is to get us out of thinking about, is just sort of ranting about the sort of state of contemporary life, and actually sort of frame it a little bit. And so if I could sort of lend my historical sense, which is based on nothing. But just looking, just what I wonder, just if you just step back a little bit and with an understanding of, like mine, that is basically zero, I look out over my, again, incredibly unlearned, naive and perhaps stupid understanding of the evolution of human being. And I think I see certain strains of the human species that maintain a certain population, maintain a certain relationship to their environment that doesn't exhaust their environment, right? I don't know if that's fair to say. I don't know if that's a completely sort of Edenic vision I have.
It's actually the argument in the book Ishmael.
It seems relatively obvious to me that for a very long time, right? And it's not that these cultures were born this way. In fact, you know, a friend of mine who has studied the Native Americans at great lengths has argued that when they first came over the Bering Strait, they came down to this country about 12,000 years ago, and they saw a lot of big, juicy animals, and they slaughtered the shit out of them. They slaughtered the shit out of them and basically made a lot of animals, drove a lot of animals into extinction, and then all of a sudden panicked and were driven into what we'll call maybe harmony. I know that sounds sort of a fruitcake term, but into a certain relationship with their environment that had them no longer, it had them in a relationship of great reverence for their environment rather than seeing it as something to consume. And then for the next 10,000 years, they pretty much maintain their populations. Then at some point, you get these little pockets, these little strains, this will to expand. This will to replicate. And what's so curious to me is from whence this drive. At what point are you sitting on your at home going, I don't like all this shit. I want more. And all I can think of is that is, by definition, the will of a virus. The virus is that which seeks its replication, even at the cost of its host. It will exhaust its host. A virus is not an intelligent being. Right? It seeks nothing but replication of the same. Right? And that is, you know, Naomi talked to me at great length about memes, and she kept thinking I was talking about memes, and in some sense I am. But the viral meme is distinct in that it seeks nothing but replication of the same and replicate that an endless, relentless replication of itself. Right, so it is a quantitative replication. Right, a meme at some point, from my very unlearned understanding of it, may be the replication of an affective experience or a gesture, and you can sort of take up somebody's taste, and it can be sort of a beautiful, enhancing experience.
It can be the smallest thing, like learning how to make a fire.
Right, or learning to enjoy tequila.
And the meme is a basic unit of replication, where it could be replicated for a large variety of reasons, like it's useful, it's good, it's beautiful, it makes you more sexy, whatever. Skinny jeans would be a meme, exactly, right. which is a fascinating one to me, because there were a bunch of medical cases a couple months ago where women were wearing such skinny jeans that they were pinching the back of their nerves, like when they sat down, and they actually went into the doctor because like their legs were getting like numb, like pinching the nerves. So that would be a good example of a.
That's my argument. So
yeah.
So my point is that there was this that just seems so obvious to me that if you step back and look at the species, right? Just as these systems of movement. This is not subtle what I'm talking about, right? Clearly there's a will at some point to replication, a will to spread. And I think my argument is that it has taken on various sort of mutations over history and various sort of forms. I think Christianity is one form, and the proselytization.
I think, right? Absolutely, religion is a great example of a meme, like most of the Abrahamic religion, all the Abrahamic religions that seek to replicate themselves and to the exclusion of other things too. They're very naturally militant, and it's not the will to that sort of replication and that sort of spread is not embodied in any one particular person. It's not the Pope. It's not a bunch of bishops. It's not that sort of thing. It's that once you adopt that, you have to. It comes with all of these extra things.
Right.
One of them includes take over people and run the Crusades when you're bored and that sort of thing.
All right, and smash up all their gods and all this shit. I mean, I saw some documentary the other day on the Incas, you know, and like this flourish. This just all of a sudden they just purged all these cultures, took them over, broke all their shit, set up all their own temples, and then died out. Right, which will happen to a virus. A virus will replicate until it exhausts itself, exhausts its environment, exhausts its host, kills its host, right? And then dies off, right? The Industrial Revolution was an incredibly virulent mutation in this virus, this will to replication of the same, right? The information economy has put a fucking exponent behind it. Right?
Absolutely. That's why we talk about things like the
unbelievable speed, just the startling speed at which any attempt to privilege private affective experience over and against, or even separate or distinct from this network of consumption, is immediately folded back into the fray. Right? And it's what Guy Debord, we were talking to Diamond Dave earlier about the situation, is we call a society of the spectacle, the will that every private experience gets extroverted into a commodity that is then consumed. And so that all your private consumption becomes, is commoditized. In, Rushkoff's book, Life Inc., you know, he says, you know, from, you know, conception to erection, right? It's all commoditized. And so, you know, one of the, needs of this virus, and one of the sort of costs, or one of the sort of symptoms of this massive acceleration, is that the body becomes inconvenient, right? The body is slow, right? And we no longer are in an industrial age in which you need bodies. You no longer need to lift. You no longer need to use your hands. You want to sit on your ass in front of a machine. What they really want, that's why they're working on voice control, because they don't even want your hands. Right? You just sit in front of your machine. It's not funny. And just tell the machine what to do. Right? And so how do you get that? Right? Well, one way you get that is kill the body. Kill it. Make it fat. Make it slow the body down. So you eliminate its desires and therefore enable human intelligence, which is not really intelligence at all, but can fill in the gaps in the computational network, right? In the network of production, right? So how do you do that? Well, first of all, keep people seated all day and for longer and longer periods of time. Own time, right? This is one of the great wills of the virus. Own time. Wake up every morning, 7:30, get in your car, drive to some godforsaken, you know, fucking cubicle in Silicon Valley, sit there all goddamn day. You don't get your own office. You don't get your own office. God forbid you should have a private moment to jerk off, pick your nose, rub your legs, have some privacy. You're all in an open space now, right? And so you will have no private experience, right? You turn and you see the chick, you know, or the dude next to you, and you're like, you know, he's hot. Nope, you're fired. Right? You're not allowed to have desire at work. It is legislated. It's not subtle. You're not allowed to fuck at work. You're not allowed to dress like you want to fuck at work. You're not allowed to talk about fucking at work. You're not allowed to look at the goddamn person next to you like you want to fuck them. Why not? Sexual harassment. So you're at work 50, 60, 70 hours a week, and you can't fuck anybody there. So when do you fuck? It's not funny. When do you fuck? You don't. They don't want you to fuck. And anybody that wants to fuck won't sit at a table 60 hours a week. You won't. You're going to get up and fuck. I mean, it's not subtle, right?
Or if you'd like to be healthy, there's no real way to get to do that. Or if you'd like to... Or if you'd like to take a nap as opposed to slog down coffee all day, there's generally no way to do that.
That's exactly. I mean, Naomi's right. That to me, fucking is just the symptom, is the metonymy of a healthy body. And so what do? You sit at your desk. Oh, I'm getting a big time out. Okay, no, we got a commercial break or something?
I think we're going to cut to a break.
It was a great time for a break. And to start
really?
That break.
It was.
I was just getting my groove on here.
We're going to let people get drinks if they want to get drinks, and we got to do a PSA.
Ah.
We've got interns to monitor these things.
All right, I guess. This is pirate, man. I want to be a pirate on pirate radio.
I'm sorry. We still have this, this time control thing.
Control, even a pirate radio.
Engineers Without Borders partners with developing communities worldwide to improve the quality of life. Their activities range from construction of sustainable engineering projects for developing communities to empowering these communities by enhancing local, technical, managerial, and entrepreneurial skills. For more info, go to ewb/sfp.org. This PSA is brought to your friends here at Pirate Radio 87.9 FM.
Number one, you have to get up and you have to work hard. You get the lawyer, you got the mortgage, you got all these payments and all these all the things you got to do, and you got to run off to the factory, whether it's the General Motors factory or a Cornell University mind robot factory, and you run in, you perform your duty, then you run home, you jump in your car and run home. Then the terrible thing about the way the industrial society has ended up, not only do you have to spend your whole life in this compartmentalization, climbing up the ladder, but then you're expected to consume. Oh, shit. I mean, it's hard work to consume. In the old days, you just went down to the market and you bought something. Now, you had to get in your car and you have to drive to the mall. And you have to get out and you have to do all these confusing things. You have to just the whole... Why? Consuming is hard work. And you have to get the ads and pull out the coupons and you have to run around and put it back in your car with the thing, get home, unpack it now and then. You have to, kick the tire and get the batteries up like that. It's a full-time job to be a robot of producing and consuming in an industrial society. Society.
Are listening to Pirate Cat Radio 87.9 FM, and we are on our monthly show called The Periodic Apocalypse. Today we have the extermination of the human host, ? And here are our guests.
Thank you, Meg. So I'm DJ Prefect, and we are continuing our conversation with Daniel Coffeen, PhD, sophist at large and tequila aficionado extraordinaire. I had a couple of clips up that you guys probably couldn't hear because there's damn a lot of people here. That's awesome. Thank you guys for coming. We're thirsty for knowledge, says Diamond Dave. We're here at Pirate Cat Radio Cafe at 21st in Florida. Our show is in progress. We're only about half done. Meg, you want to play the sitting thing by Dr. Monty Ladner from the Fitness Rocks podcast? He's a former practicing physician. You got it?
Current recommendations for physical activity are 30 minutes per day of moderate intensity exercise at least 5 days a week. This is for adults. This level of activity is associated with a lower risk for developing most chronic diseases, but most people are not doing this. And the news gets even worse when you consider that some researchers, perhaps many researchers, believe that this minimum 30 minutes per day of exercise may not represent enough calories burned to reduce the growing prevalence of obesity in our society. And this is because most people, even if they do some exercise, are spending the majority of their day doing nothing or practically nothing. It's shocking. And this unnaturally sedentary lifestyle, combined with consuming excessive amounts of poor quality food, have created a society in which two-thirds of the adult population are either overweight or obese. Recent research has investigated the health impact of prolonged sedentary activity, which for most people means sustained sitting either at work or in front of a television. Many people, according to the authors of one of these papers, many people are spending over 50% of their waking hours sitting.
Yeah, that about sums it up. We sit a lot. We're sitting right now. This is not exactly how we evolved. There was a lot of running away from things and running into things and collecting things and hunting things down.
I mean, it's funny. I think if you, my mic is turned orange and swollen.
Yeah, we swapped the mics in thanks to a helpful intern.
I just realized I'm putting my mouth in. Swollen redhead.
Think nothing
right,
of
you
it.
You can forget about, you know, forget about the historical argument. You know, I think it can be more or less interesting. You could forget about causes. It doesn't interest me all that much. What interests me is the diagnostic or the symptomology, and it's not subtle, right? You turn on television, which I watch a lot of because I'm a idiot, and that's not fair because I think television could be a good medium, but I'm talking about stupid television like ESPN. In primetime television, there are ads for two products I see often. One is called Viagra, and one is called Cialis. These are common ads. I'm sure you've all heard of these things. What the fuck? It's like a canary in the mine. We are an impotent culture. That's, I mean, these are primetime ads. These cost a lot of money. Like, a lot of people are popping these pills, and people say, well, the boomers are getting old, and they just want to keep fucking into their 80s. It's like, yeah.
Greedy bastards.
I'm not so sure, right? It gets interpreted as a will to more pleasure, when in fact, it speaks to the evacuation of pleasure. We are impotent. I don't think we even want to fuck, but you know what? We need to, because we need to keep producing babies, because cloning is not there yet. Right? Once cloning is in place, we won't actually need our, you know, schlongs anymore, or, you know, whatever you got. Your junk, as the kids say.
I'm starting to think about The Matrix.
Yeah, it absolutely is. That movie is one of the most clear critiques of contemporary, I'll call it capitalism. But either way, forget this word capitalism if you want to. What I'm speaking to is a systematic eradication of pleasure. You know, there are people who may find pleasure in their work, but I would argue that more often than not, these people have been evacuated by the demands of their work, and so that they think they're receiving their pleasure from their work, right? But in fact, they are driving, you know, they are the greatest tools of a corporate exercise. And so, you know, there's the workplace in which your time is increasingly occupied, increasingly owned. The information revolution, right? I mean, I just got one of these stupid little widgets, these iPhones, just so I'm on 24/7, right? Went from 40 hours a week. Last time I was offered a work contract, an actual work contract, which is a real rare thing because I've rarely worked. It was 50 hours base, right? It was just assumed you work 50 hours, right? And that's, for people I know who work, that's nothing, right? Most people I know in the so-called creative industries of San Francisco work probably a minimum of 60, closer to 70 hours a week. And that's considered normal, right? Not necessarily all at the office, but always computing, always on, always responding, always working, right? So your time is so thoroughly owned. While you're there, you're eating shit, right? There was a Wendy's ad I noticed recently of a charming young woman smiling as she ate a wrap and as she navigated the workspace, right? She's like tripping over wires and she's like negotiating everyone and she's smiling because she's got this wad of fat in her hands. That's her lunch. She's not sitting down to enjoy a meal. What happened to the two martini lunch? Which was already an aberration, but now you don't even get that. You get a fucking Wendy's wrap, right? So you're working all the time, and you get sicker and sicker. This is meat that's infused with antibiotics. Right? You get home, you're so tired, right? But what happens when you get home? What happens when you get home? Fact is, your spouse had to work too. We are now two income households, right? So there's no calm, not that it was ever calm, but whoever, you know, your wife, your husband, you come home, there is annoyed and dehydrated from the salty fat they ate all day. They never got to shit in public, they never got to shit in private, so they're just like, they're all gassed, stomach hurts, like farting uncomfortably. They're tired, their kid comes home. And we'll talk about childhood in a minute, which is being just abused and always has been by our schools. And there are insane industrial notions of productivity. But your kid's nuts because he's been at fucking school since 7 in the morning. The kid's shrieking, right? Everyone's wiped out. What do you do? What does everybody in this country do? The overwhelming majority of people. They pop a pill. Ambien, Xanax, right?
Ritalin for kids.
Right. Ritalin, Adderall during the day to make you productive. Xanax and Ambien at night to put you down.
Let's not forget the Starbucks.
Right, so that's what I was going to say. So then you wake up and you're fucking exhausted. You're exhausted. You go to bed too late, you watch some late night movie, and you're fucking tired when you wake up. So what do you do? What is there on every corner in downtown America? I was just in Manhattan this past week, right, in Midtown. I walked 5 blocks and saw 3 Starbucks, right? It was shocking. Why? Because you're so tired that you need caffeine, right? The rise of coffee culture in this country is not equated with delectation or with pleasure, with savoring a cup of coffee. The assumptions we have about the coffee shop in this country is that it's a place you bring your laptop. It is a meeting place. It is an extension of capitalism. It is not the coffee shop of Europe. It is not the coffee shop of South America, which in turn are being eradicated and brought up by Starbucks. Starbucks is an extension, literal extension of the workplace that fuels you, not just with caffeine. You don't go and get a double espresso like they do in Italy or in France. You get a fucking grande latte, right? Which is like this much coffee in a vat of antibiotic fat milk.
Yeah, I want to dwell on the coffee thing for a little bit because, for one thing, the majority of the chemical substance that you get in a latte or a cafe au lait or whatever you get is the milk. And, it's this return to infancy. Sipping at the teat, basically. And actually, I know you don't really dig the science and the historical aspect, but screw you. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that when you digest milk, you release something called exorphins into your bloodstream. And these are digestive consequences of the proteins in milk, and also in wheat, actually, incidentally, that act exactly like opioids. So the consumption of milk in tiny, tiny, I mean, even in these tiny doses is releasing an opioid compound in your brain. And again, same thing with bread, same thing when you digest gluten. You're releasing an opioid compound, does exactly the same thing, just in a tiny...
A muffin, and you're shooting junk while still being... But it's no longer junk.
No.
And that's what's amazing, is that junk has been transformed. I'm looking at a beautiful, huge picture of William S. Burroughs, right? And you know, who was the last time in our culture where we had a public vanguard of an anti-capitalist stance, of a public avant-garde, who you
just
know?
for the people who don't have the visual, yeah. here in the Pirate Cat Radio Cafe, back in the studio, we have the remnants of an art gallery opening by Michael Jang, a photographer, who took this fantastic photo of Burroughs.
Yeah, that I'm going to steal when I leave. It is unreal.
You'll have to contend with our fearless dictator monkey.
But junk,
I think I would
junk,
like to see that.
The drug experience is actually worth talking about for a moment. Because
his picture is right to the left.
Is that right? Drugs have been co-opted by the pharmaceuticals, right? Some people may or may not know. It is when I came to San Francisco in 1991, there was LSD being sold on every... I mean, you couldn't walk down Haight Street without being offered doses, you know. For under $5, you could take a hit of acid. When was the last time you were offered acid on the streets of Berkeley or San Francisco? It is one... The DEA quotes it as one of their great success stories. They pretty much shut down LSD.
So why LSD?
Because LSD is, well, it was shut down because it was easy enough to shut down. It turns out it's hard enough to make.
I mean, why do you fixate on?
Right. Because acid is a completely unproductive drug. It is about purely private affective experience. The drugs that have replaced it are Adderall, speed, right? Drugs that can make you more productive, to focus you rather than drive a true network thinking, right? Across diverse planes, it actually makes you driven, right? I mean, there was an article in the New Yorker, the only thing I read a few weeks ago, it's humiliating, about the rise of Adderall amongst you college kids. I didn't know that's what you guys were all on. You all looked fucking dead tired to me. Should have taken more of it, right? But or you take the rise of Xanax, the rise of all the opiates, all the pharmaceutical opiates. So junk picture the junkie, right? You picture them out on the street, and it doesn't look pretty, but it is not productive. They really jam up a lot of the capitalist will to replication, right? Because it moves slowly, and it's bodily, it's vomitous, it's incredibly visceral experience. And it has been usurped and replaced with hyper-refined doses, Oxycontin and Xanax and Valium. And Valium was already not clean enough, right? These very high control doses of heroin, right, to keep you fucking stupid, right?
And here's another fallacy of the whole caffeine addiction thing. So let's say, okay, great, I'm not going to go for the latte or the cafe au lait, so on and so forth. I'm tired. I really need a coffee. It turns out that taking a nap is it's better, like statistically, for productivity than drinking the coffee. And so I actually would argue with you. I don't think that the intent is to produce a productive state of mind, but more this kind of like zombie state of mind, like keep going back to the water cooler kind of state of mind, like stay at work a little bit longer because like, oh shoot, I didn't actually get anything done this afternoon. It turns out that taking a nap for 20 to 30 minutes, rejuvenates your brain to a much greater degree than the caffeine that you would have to probably take 20 to 30 minutes to either prepare or go to buy anyway.
I don't think those two things are opposed, right? Because they want to keep you awake, but dopey.
Right. Not actually producing so that you feel, so maybe you're producing a little bit, but you feel guilty about the fact that you're not producing as much as you should.
Right. It is, and I mean, you think about the things that, again, that drive this, you know? I mean, take a company like just flew JetBlue recently. And JetBlue, the first time I flew them, they were a privately held company. And it was a different experience when you got on their plane. They were actual human beings who greeted you at the counters. They were articulate. They were empowered.
That's fascinating.
Acted like human beings. And, you know, this company was incredibly successful. They were making, you know, hundreds and hundreds. I mean, they were in the billions of dollars. They were exceeded the hundreds of millions, moved into the billions of dollars. But that was not enough. They went public. You have to go public. The logic of the street, the logic of the market, right, is to constantly expand, right? A company that is publicly traded cannot be static. It has to always be growing. It is the drive of every publicly traded company to keep growing. And I remember reading about their IPO, and I'm like, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah, we literally define a company's success in terms of whether it's growing or not.
Why do that? All the investors are making tons of money. All the owners are making tons of money. What's the problem? It's literally insane. What is that trigger? Right? It means we have to put an exponent behind growth. And that is what Wall Street is. Wall Street is the will to the exponential growth, to exponential expansion, and to relentless expansion that drives every company, which in turn means every sort of qualitative component of its entity, of its system, including the human being as consumer and employee, gets reduced to a quantity. How many do I got? What am I paying them? How many can I move? I don't know who I'm selling my shit to. I don't know who's getting on my plane. I know that I have 500 bodies, 500,000 bodies, 5 million bodies. I always want more. It is the will of Wall Street. And it was incredibly upsetting to me when we witnessed its collapse, which is inevitable. It gets considered like somehow we fucked up. And this is a great clip, link that I put on the Facebook invitation for this ad from Paul Virilio about this very thing. That is, as if somehow capitalism screwed up, as opposed to this being inherent or imminent to it. It will exhaust itself. That is what it does. This is not an accident. No one screwed up. This is what values, it reaches this point at which speed can't keep up with value, right? And then it begins to disintegrate. But what happened with this Barack Obama is that he resuscitated it, right? Immediately the assumption was resuscitate Wall Street. If you turn on any fucking news show, which I never do except on JetBlue because it's the only television show they have, and what runs down the bottom is a little ticker that tells you what the Dow is, how Wall Street's doing. And if it's pointing up, things are looking up. But that's literally nothing. Nothing has happened. The assessment of success is this abstraction of more. There's an economist called David Corret who just recently wrote a book called Phantom Wealth, who argues that, if you want to look at the success of an economy, right, really look at the success of the economy. What we consider success is an ever-increasing gross national product. The higher it is, the more successful we are.
In fact, if it stops, we consider it death.
Yeah.
Basically. If we are not increasing, then we are, then something, exactly, something's wrong.
So he says, well, what do you get for your money? We have a decreasing level of graduation. Our schools are a fucking nightmare. Our healthcare is a nightmare. Our mortality is decreasing. Our baby mortality is increasing. We have the worst, you know, decline. I don't say the worst. We have perhaps the worst healthcare in the so-called developed world.
I think Portugal is worse than us. No, honestly, I was looking at a graph about a couple days ago comparing the U.S. healthcare statistics in terms of mortality, infant mortality,
it's
obesity,
yeah,
length of time stay in hospitals, and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
On a list of 20 to 30, I can't remember the number of industrialized countries, it was only Portugal that was listed lower than us. And the other salient detail is that all of these countries have universalized healthcare.
And so this guy's argument was so clean, right? Because in classic economic terms, the lower your lifestyle sort of rating, right? If you're looking at healthcare and education, The lower that, with the higher your GNP, your gross national product, you're paying more and more for less and less. So that's a sign of failure. His argument was your GNP should be lower. You should be paying less and less for more and more. Right? Your expenditure should be minimal. Right? That rather than looking at the GNP as production, he looks at it as your expenditure.
Well, in terms of the GNP, the Exxon Valdez disaster was a great success. We generated a lot of economic activity. It was actually the most successful economic venture of an oil tanker in the history of anything.
That's beautiful. So I'm on the plane and I flew Virgin into New York. I flew JetBlue out, the cool, sexy little airlines, right? And on both of them, you can buy on the plane these carbon offsets, which sums up the speed of capitalism, right? So I don't even know how to begin to just explain why that's so incredibly disturbing to me. So rather than not flying, you're encouraged to fly and then spend more. It's always more. Buy something else. So now what I'm buying is the carbon offset. I'm buying my conscience, right? Which is basically the logic of the green, the way environmentalism is, you know, and I know this will piss people off, is capitalism, right? It looks at the wrong things and it buys into the logic of more. You look at something like a green car. What the fuck is a green car? We talk about that and we feel good because we drive a Prius. You want to know what a green car is? It's called your fucking feet. Your feet. There's no such thing as a green car. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, you get an electric car and then you expect that, oh, it's all solved because you're not burning something locally, but your turbines are turning somewhere. You have to generate the electricity at somewhere. You know, either it's going to be nuclear energy that sends you the electricity, or it's going to be coal. There's something going to be burning. It's not going to be, green car.
What's happened with environmentalism is, A, they look at the wrong thing. They look at resources, right? Geological resources. When the first resource that capitalism needs and that it exhausts with a relentless furor is human vitality, right? It is a vampiric beast. It is the nature of the corporation to need bodies to drive its success. It is essentially a vampire. It is essentially a virus. That is its structure. That's not something that happens accidentally. It's not an ornament to the beast. It is imminent to the beast. That is what a corporation is. It is necessarily, fundamentally, always already a vampire. It needs human vitality to drive its wealth. And it is accelerating its need for your juice. So when it needed 40 hours, 50 hours, 60 hours, it needs you always on, always on, always on. And every attempt to move outside of it gets immediately folded back in so they can get your resource. They can get your juice. They can get your vitality, your soul, the thing that drives you, the very spark, your chi. Right?
All right. Where are we at, Meg? Should we take a break? Do a PSA?
We
come
can
back?
Do that. Let's
okay,
do
great.
That. Do we have a volunteer for a PSA? I think you had some.
I think we should get Justin to do a PSA.
All right. Come on in, Justin. Step up.
Yeah. Go in the studio. Step on up, buddy. You're the next contestant on The PSA is Right or Wrong.
You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio. This is 87.9 FM, if you've forgotten. And here's Justin with our last PSA.
East Bay Innovations is a nonprofit agency dedicated to assisting people with developmental disabilities in Alameda County who live in their own homes and to be employed in jobs of their choosing. To achieve this, EBI provides an array of support services and help in accessing and utilizing community resources. For more information, go to eastbayinnovations.com. This PSA is brought to you from your friends at Pirate Cat Radio 87.9 FM.
Go back to bed, America. Your government is in control again. Here's American Gladiators. Watch this. Shut up. Go back to bed, America. Here's American Gladiators. Here is 56 channels of it. Watch these pituary retards bang their fucking skulls together and congratulate you on living in the land of freedom. Here you go, America. You are free to
You are listening to 87.9 FM Pirate Cat Radio. This is the monthly periodic apocalypse. And Daniel Coffin and Naomi have more to say about how parasitic capitalism consumes, confines, and controls us.
Says Diamond
That's
Dave.
The question.
We
That's
are
the
going question. To open it up to questions and discussion as promised. We have about a half hour to do this. So who has a question? Come on up. What's your name?
Timmy. All right. So in the discussion, I've heard a couple of points, and I want to bring in a few things. Now, you were talking about the opiates that were used, and I come from a city called Hong Kong, the epitome of colonialism and its effect on a tradition that has lasted 4,000 years, and the war was fought on opium. Now we have opiates for the masses, literal or imagined. Now, what that brings me to is that even the Native Americans had a comment. I heard this at the City College of San Francisco, where they were doing a ritual for the sun, and they said that at the very beginning, when the colonizers came to America, one of the captains had said that we have a disease in the heart, a disease for desire, the disease of gold. Where really, do you think something shiny, like that piece of jewelry you're wearing, is it really worth more than the food that can feed your children? Is it really? And also,
do you have a question? Do you have a question?
I do have a question. Now, what are your thoughts?
Your point is well taken. There are many opiates that placate the masses.
Yes, yes.
Well, it's what Burroughs calls, again, the junk equation. And he talks about the X inside, right? And the he calls it, his phrase in Naked Lunch is the algebra of need, right? And it's that X inside that's that lack, right? And it can be junk, it can be gold, it can be shoes.
So what is really an easy solution? Is there an easy solution to the addiction to opiates that the society has been overtaken?
Well, I got to say, to me, the question is not really about the addiction to opiates per se as much. I mean, I suppose that could be the extrapolation of the summation of the issue, but to me, it's, you know, the question that kind of gets begged is from whence this beast? What is the nature of power and how does one resist it, right? And the argument I'd make is that there is no them. It's not the boss versus the employees. It's not Wall Street versus us, right? Someone who works on Wall Street and someone who works in a nonprofit are equally capitalists in my view, right? They're equally infected with this virus. And that is not...
Well, the one needs the other.
I mean, you can work on Wall Street and actually be an enjoyer, not a consumer. That is not the sign. That is not what I'm talking about. There is no they. There is no them. Power, in all respect to Michel Foucault, is a bottom-up and a horizontal beast, right, that infiltrates from the inside out. Burroughs refers to the quantitative virus, that one of its tricks is to own the word and to own the inner voice. So the things that you think you need, the very ways in which you define yourselves privately and at night, and, you know, when you're wallowing in your own, you know, self, that moment, that's where the virus infiltrates. It's not a they. It's a virus. It's a fucking virus. It's not a they. Right? And what's happened is that the virus has infected the beast so thoroughly that it's hard to separate the virus from the animal.
I'm going to weigh in with my annoying scientific perspective. Which
it's
is
not annoying. It's useful and interesting.
Thank you. Finally.
Irrelevant, but interesting.
Right, thank you. Irrelevant. In the Paleolithic sphere, in the prehistory, we evolved in this basically a poverty of stimuluses. We evolved to be attracted to certain things that we theorized that we survivally based theorized would not occur again in our environments, like large collections of fat and sugar, you know, could gorge on those whenever you find those. That's the heuristic that that exists in our brains. And the fact that we've been able to surpass this poverty, in general, basically hijacks our senses and hijacks our ability to cope. And we have to basically come up with a whole different set of mechanisms, this whole set of heuristics for dealing with the world that we've created. And so to answer the question, what is the solution? It's just fucking consciousness, just realizing that we've created this society of plenty and you can't accede to it. And you can also realize that the more you indulge in something, the less pleasurable it becomes. I will give trust and cede the floor to my friend Justin Jackson here.
So, Caffeine, you're absolutely right. Bottom up. I've been a vampire all my life. Been a commissioned salesperson for forever. And there's nothing outside of an individual you need to sell them something. It's in there. And your job as a salesman is to go in and find out what it is. They're the corporation. They're the drive. They're the consumer. And selling cars, green cars especially. Love the green car. Drive this car and you can drive it more than you drove your old car. Yeah, you can drive this car twice as far you're not hurting the planet at all. No, it's beautiful. It's clean. And what it is in a car sales environment, the objective, the number one objective every car salesman has is to get you to drive a car, to test drive it. Because then we have a word for it. Once you've driven it, you have the ether. You have this thing where you are now involved with this car. You're now in love. You're imagining yourself. You're getting this four-wheel drive Jeep, four-door, so that you can take this imagined trip in your head to go kayaking. You don't have a kayak. It doesn't matter. You're in love. You're free. You can go anywhere in this world with this four-wheel drive, which you'll use once to go over a bump in Las Vegas freaking parking lot just because you can. You got to use it once. But that ether that happens with people, it's inside them. It's nothing I said. I didn't say anything to convince you. I didn't say anything to manipulate you. I just put you in front of a car and let you drive it. And once you did that, inside your brain, you flipped that switch. You said, I have to have this. And that's really where the capitalism happens. It's not even in advertising. They're just trying to find that trigger and unlock that little thing. It's all in your head. All of it.
Yeah. It's all simultaneous. It's not a cause and effect. It's not that there's first advertising and then the effect.
So many people wanted stuff. Right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
There's this awesome book that I heartily recommend by Clotaire Rapaille, who's a French guy who's a consultant to Fortune 500 companies, that his job is to go around unlocking the culture code. The book is called Culture Code, to marketing products, to the product, like the very base product itself, not Volkswagen cars, but cars in general. So what is the core concept, like the culture code behind cars, because if you find that code and you attack that, then you've kind of hacked into the brain essentially, and you can sell more cars. He's decided, and he has made this entirely successful recommendation to car companies, that the culture code in America for cars is identity, and that once you've tapped into the identity of a person and said, like, look, check out this Hummer. You know, it's not well engineered. It doesn't get any good miles to the big gallon, and it's going to need all sorts of expensive maintenance. But just imagine your cute little wife driving this Hummer down the road. Just imagine the possibilities, the crazy, like you were saying, like the totally imaginary possibilities of driving this Hummer down the road. And that's what sells. It's identity. This is not the case in other cultures. This is not the case in, for instance, Germany, where the culture code, what sells cars in Germany is engineering. Is it going to last 10 years? Is it going to go 100 kilometers per hour down the Autobahn and things like that? Things that you would think would go into the you know, into the goodness of a car in America too, but it just turns out to be not the case, that people buy cars based on identity. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. It's just that here's a marketing expert who's a consultant to Fortune 500 companies, and he's basically distilled it down to that in terms of sales. You know, what sells is identity in this culture.
I have another question here.
Hi, Jason.
Hi, Naomi. So I get this concept that you're throwing out that I've heard and read and it has been passed down. Like, capitalism has this never-ending void, like, buy, make. It's not that, you know, I get it. It's not that, you know, $10,000, no, I need more. $1 million, no, I can still make more, whatnot. But this problem that I have with what you've been saying, not with you, but this conversation that's been, you know, just thrown at our way all this time, is we're taking the responsibility away from the individual. We're always blaming this capitalistic structure as the problem, rather than saying, like, eventually, and I was talking to your students outside and they made me think of this, rather than, like, eventually we have to take responsibility to the individual and say, like, yeah, you live inside of this capitalistic structure, and yeah, like, it's fucked up, and, you know, like, we have these fucking computers here and these monitors and everything's all fucked up, but, like, one of these times, you fucking bastard, like, you have to take advantage, like, you have to realize, like, you're the one that's living in this capitalistic structure, you're the one that's perpetuating this shit, and you're the one that they're feeding, you're the one that's perpetuating it. Like when does the line draw that we stop blaming capitalism and we start blaming the individuals for relying on this complacent passive existence that they reside upon?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I know the risk with using this phrase capitalism is that it suggests a system that's exterior to ourselves, and what I want to do is exactly what you're saying. That to me, the thing I don't understand is when we all sign that contract to agree to these terms, right? And we sign that contract every fucking morning when we agree that we're going to be there by 9 a.m., that we're going to go home at 6 p.m., that we say yes. We come home, we're miserable. We're either constipated, we have the runs, we're impotent, we're fighting with our wives, but we say, I have no choice. And I agree. I mean, I was talking to Diamond Dave about this. How do you foment change? What are the terms of change? Is there a possibility that everybody, does it have to be collective? What happens if you do it individually? I'll tell you personally that when I've tried to resist it, for the most part, the system tries to starve me out, right? They'd rather exterminate me. They fire me, and they refuse to employ me, right? And at some point, I'm fucked, right? They make me either, you know, not to be crass, but like, they make me do things I don't want to do in order to be able to support and pay for my kid. And the terms of resistance are hard. It is the courage that one needs to summon, the equation, right, of the courage one needs to summon to resist becomes greater and greater, becomes more and more skewed against you, right? And that maybe there's power in a collective, right? Is there a day we can say, you know what? Can you get on BART and say, you motherfuckers, you're all going to work at 8:30 in the morning. Just don't go. Do you want to go? Do you want to go to work? Just don't go. But is that going to happen? No, because they are the virus. So I want Diamond Dave to talk to this for a minute, because at some point I want to say there is no resistance. We are fucked. There is nothing to do except die. Truly.
I
want to head to the hills, but there are no hills to head to. The network has infiltrated so thoroughly that there's nowhere to go.
Do we have a caller? Should we take the caller live? Throw caution to the wind. Take one caller at random.
Hang on a second.
Yeah, I disagree. I don't think we're fucked. Who? What's going on?
We have a caller here.
I just want to say that I think you guys need to learn how to walk sideways.
I like it. Say more.
Keep going.
Say more.
I think that you guys need to learn how to walk sideways.
Explain. Say more.
Yeah, like if the city requires you to pull permits to remodel your bathroom, walk sideways. Pull the permit.
I like it, yeah.
Don't
I agree.
Have them sign it at the end. Don't have them come do the final sign off.
That's
Tell
radical living.
Hey, we're doing a little bit of work. It's cool. don't pay the city shit to fucking
Where are you calling in from, Tyler? Where are you calling in from? Are you listening live on the radio?
Yeah, I'm listening totally live. I'm hearing me, whatever. But what I want to talk about is that, you know what? You guys are stressed out about being, like, getting pinned. Fuck that shit, man. You have all the power to walk sideways. Think about all the ways that you can go around all this crap. Fuck that. I hate all this shit. I get all stressed out about all these little tiny details about what the man wants you to do, quarterly taxes. I gotta pay this. I gotta pay that. I'm not gonna do that shit. I'm gonna walk around that shit. Hey, bro, pay me cash. Yeah, man, I'll fucking have half the cash, put the hash on the other fucking count, whatever, man. I'm pissed. And I'd never want to fucking give this city shit because you know what? They make it too hard to hang out and make your house nice. They always want to be up your ass. They're going to look up your ass with a flashlight.
Thank you for that optimism.
I'm a renter, so my issues are...
I absolutely agree. Walk sideways. I think that there are
sideways,
I think there are
man,
incredible...
Think about it. Like, you can pull a permit for your house. Like, say you want to remodel your kitchen. Pull the permit and then do all the work you got to do and just never have them sign it.
Awesome. Thank
you very
much.
And then if somebody goes, oh, you didn't pull a permit, you can say, you know what, fuck you. Here's my permit. It just never got signed off.
Thank you,
Kyle. There you go.
Thank you, sir. No, I absolutely agree. There are an incredible amount of things that you can do within the city sphere to create an alternative community, to participate in microsystems.
Talk about the slow food thing a little bit.
Okay.
I posted a comment on my article on my blog a few months ago where I said, what happened to the avant-garde? And what I realized I really meant is what happened to the public-facing sites of resistance, right? And it's when I was reading reports from the bunker, right? These great conversations with Burroughs hanging out with Tennessee Williams and Andy Warhol and Lou Reed, and they're just sitting around talking. All these guys are public figures, yet they're so far outside of the consumptive machine, right? And I was like, where are these guys now? We don't have a public face. And a few people, independent of each other, who don't know each other, posted in response, and they mentioned the so-called slow food movement and the rise of sort of independent farm communities that in which true freakdom flourishes, in which they grow a bunch of vegetables, they come into town, sell it to we consumers, and then back off and create their art in independence, right? They're not moving through the gallery system. They're not moving through, any sort of public display. The avant-garde has moved to the private. The resistance has become private because when resistance moves public, it gets owned very quickly, right? I mean, the example in that blog that I use is Vincent Gallo, who really tried to resist the Hollywood machine, right? And created his own funding, wrote, produced, directed his own music for his films. And what the fuck happens? He ends up creating, you know, modeling for H&M and doing vodka ads, right? He gets folded in. The minute he resists, he gets folded in as a brand attribute of vodka that's all about resistance. Right? And they run an ad in which he like marks up somebody's piece of work, right? The speed with which your public resistance gets folded back in to a commodity is staggering. So I think resistance becomes a private thing, becomes something that happens literally, you know, you try to operate outside the society of the spectacle. Unfortunately, I just don't know where literally that space is.
It's basically, it's consciousness. Did you have something to say?
I did, dancing sideways down the ribbon of time, the path ahead lit by the echo behind. In other words, you mentioned Bill Burroughs and the Beats as being out in the avant-garde of social, cultural, and political change. And it's been up to now pretty much by choice, but now more and more people as the economy continues to collapse, as you said. This is this virus collapsing like a house of cards from within, like a cascade of dominoes falling. And so I see this network of collaboratives, cooperatives, autonomous units around the city, around the state, around the country, and around the planet beginning to emerge, taking down the walls, opening the doors, and getting rid of the borders too, saying families, bands, tribes, communities, collectives, I believe in that, but borders, just a line on their map, and to realize these borders are totally artificial, that international capitalism in dividing up the world has really put them up. And it's time to take them down, and they are falling. We talked about a new underground railway. We talked about, or let me tell this story, because it'll give you something to do, to take it on. So I'm 71 years old, so I go back to the Beat Generation, so I've seen it. I've also seen the growth of alternative, you mentioned the opiates, the junk culture going back all the way to Burroughs in the 30s and before. But now we also see the growth. Before, back when I was a beatnik in 1957, we used to go close, shut the windows, put paper under the door, you could go to jail for 3 years to just for smoking a joint. And now it's the largest cash crop in the country, one of those in the world. And in fact, almost everybody has smokes taking down those walls. And this is a total alternative thing. It's not part of capitalism so much. Everybody's got it's 420. It's 420. And if it's 420, let's go on out. It's our time. So we want to make it 420 24/7 around here. And anyway, I wanted to do this bit. So anyway, at the Barnes & Noble bookstore a couple months ago, I just ran with this. They noticed that there was nothing planned. It was a renegade reading. Where are all these people, all these anarchists going up to the fourth floor where usually the great book tours start? And instead, it was a renegade reading of this manifesto. And the manifesto talks about all of this. It's called The Coming Insurrection. And they put it out there in the New York Times, and now it's available on the Internet. So go home and Google The Coming Insurrection, because this is a manifesto pointing out that there is an alternative, and this alternative is this growing network of collaborations, collectives, of people being forced out of the economy and being forced to find ways to support themselves and one another, whether it be in community gardens or whatever. So find your brothers and sisters, get together, and keep on surviving, and fuck them. They're coming down. And we're going up. The new society is being born in the shell of the old.
Thank you, Diamond Dave. I want to take one more comment from a friend of mine from Noisebridge, actually. Noisebridge is sort of a totally consensus-driven hacker community here in San Francisco, which I consider to be one of those walking sideways sorts of things that our caller was talking about. But I think that he's kind of benevolent hackers, actually, except for the ones that are not quite so kind of benevolent. Jake Applebaum just cracked the SF parking meters, so take that as you will.
What was on? It was on Black Hat. Like it was on Wire. Like it was big news today. It's not.
It was on Wire. Okay, forget Black Hat.
So, I'm going to be a real rebel here today.
Ooh.
And,
we only have 5 minutes.
Okay. I want to defend the machine.
Keep going.
We live in a world which, by any conceivable objective measure, gives more life individually to more people who have more determination on what they do, who live their lives in less desperation, who live their lives in less fear and pain for longer periods.
Sorry. I need to cut you off early just because the response to this will basically take us to the end of the show. And there's another show coming on right after this, Psionic Dehesins. So, do you have a response?
I don't know. All I know is my life, and all I know is I want to have some pleasure, and I know I can't get it. So I don't know what you're talking about. We're going to compare it. It's not a critique. I literally don't know what you're talking about. So I mean, I don't mean that as a critique. Again, it's just a fact. You're talking about, like, I don't know, one of these. I don't know about countries in the world or other countries in the world. I don't know people in France. I don't know.
You think I think you need to nail it down. About, yeah. I think you need to nail it down to like one specific metric. Is that what? Can you do that?
Yeah. Sure.
How many of your own teeth do you still have?
Yeah, that's interesting that you would ask. I have my teeth. What I don't have is the time to raise my child, fuck my wife, read, and produce to my culture. I don't have the time. There's literally not the time. My time has been known. My teeth are still here. They've given me my teeth. You're right. And if that's success for you, happy to you, and you win. And I think there's a breed in our culture of people like designers and developers who are happy because they fit the capitalist machine. They are, but for those who actually make art, the world is a much more complicated place.
Okay, we've got about 30 seconds left. Yeah. Sorry.
No, that's fine.
All right. So, if there is a point to this discussion, I think that is that if there is a problem, if there is a problem with the system, you can decide that you want to live in this system. That it's perfectly fine, go on about your business, work 60 hours per week at the same real wages as 1970s and keep on acquiring debt because that's your program. That's fine. If you're happy doing that, that's great. If you're not happy doing that, what is the way out? We don't really know. I think this whole session has been about raising consciousness. And so if there is a way out, I think that's it. Because if there is a future and it has to involve a higher consciousness, I can't conceive of a future that we don't have time for questions. We have to do it peacefully. We have to, because war is what got us here in the first place.
Amen.
Pirate Cat Radio, 87.9 FM. Thank you very much to everybody who came out. We have a packed house tonight. And stay tuned because there's more Pirate Cat Radio.
Your cell phone, your world, your time, your ideas, no barcode, no party, no ID, no beers, your bank card, your license, your thoughts, your fears, no SIM card, no disco, no photo, not here, your blood, your sweat, your passions, your regrets, your profits, your time off, your fashions, your sex, your pills, your grass, your tits, your ass, your laughs, your balls, we won't,
we want your soul.
Your fats, your fears. Give us your address, your shoe size, your ears, your digits, your plans, your number, your eyes, your schedule, your desktop, your details, your life. Show us your children, your photos, your home. Here, take credit, take insurance, take a loan. Get a job, get a pension, get a haircut, get a suit. Play the lottery, play football, play the field, or some toot. We'll show you shrink, we'll show you sleep, we'll buy you drinks, we'll pay your bill, we'll sell you crap, we'll charge you debt. Wanna buy big guns in the front of cash? Your dreams, your checkbook, your essence, your sweat, your screams, your security, your sobriety, your innocence, your society, yourself, your place, your distance, your space.
Go back to bed, America. Your government is in control again. Here, watch this. Shut up. You are free to do as we tell you. You are free to do as we tell you.
Here's Britney, here's cola, here's pizza, here's TV, here's some rock, and some roller. Watch commercials, more commercials, watch Jerry, not Oprah. Buy a better life, from the comfort of your sofa. Here's popcorn, here's magazines, here's milkshake, here's blue jeans, here's padded bars, here's armpit dress, here's football shirt, here's baseball cap, here's live talk shows, here's video games, here's Cola Life, here's Tin Lola, here's filter tips, here's college minutes, here's all night balls, here's plastic
cake. We want your soul.
Go back to bed, America. Your government is in control again. Here, here's American Gladiators. Watch this. Shut up. Go back to bed, America. Here is American Gladiators. Here is 56 channels of it. Watch these pituary retards bang their fucking skulls together and congratulate you on living in the land of freedom. Here you go, America. You are free to do as we tell you. You are free to do as we tell you.
No truth, no song.
Your soul.
Your heart.
Your mind.